Good evening and welcome. I'm Amna Nawaz.
And I'm Jeff Bennett. On the NewsHour tonight, Russia bombards critical infrastructure in Kyiv, while in the east, Ukraine carries out one of the deadliest attacks against Russian forces since the war started.
Pakistan struggles to recover from historic flooding that killed more than 1,700 people as waters refuse to recede.
4 months after the flood, this school in the Dadu district, like so many others, remains inaccessible to students. Its first floor still completely inundated.
And a new COVID subvariant spreads rapidly in the Northeast, sparking concerns over how well it can evade existing vaccines. Good evening, and welcome to the NewsHour. Our lead story tonight is Ukraine, where the new year has brought little respite from Russia's war and little hope of peace.
Air raid sirens blared, and explosions boomed today under a new barrage of exploding drones. In turn, the Ukrainians confirmed they carried out a weekend attack that killed scores of Russian troops. We'll get details after today's headlines.
At the Vatican today, some 65,000 people filed through St. Peter's Basilica as Pope Emeritus Benedict lay in state for the first of 3 days. Many of the faithful waited for hours to pay their respects. Benedict had retired from the papacy a decade ago. He died Saturday at the age of 95.
Compared to a funeral, this is an occasion in which you have a more personal experience. We came to say thanks, to ask something. You have the feeling of being in front of someone who made it to the other side. It's been a beautiful prayer.
A funeral will be held Thursday in St. Peter's Square. Meantime, in Brazil, many thousands of mourners paid tribute to soccer legend Pelé in his hometown of Santos. The only player ever to win 3 World Cups died last Thursday at age 82 after battling cancer. The 24-hour public viewing was held at the stadium where Pelé scored some of his most memorable goals. The head of the International Soccer Federation, known as FIFA, was among the first to arrive.
Pelé leaves an incredible legacy for football, a unique legacy. Pelé had, the gift of God, a gift that very few people on earth have. And it's a gift to touch the hearts and the emotions of people.
There's a funeral mass in Santos tomorrow with a burial to follow. Latin American leaders welcomed back Brazil's new president, Lula da Silva, today. He had a string of meetings on his first full day in office. Lula was sworn in Sunday after he narrowly defeated far-right incumbent Jair Bolsonaro in October. The change puts Brazil back on a leftist track. For his part, Bolsonaro skipped the inauguration and flew to Florida. It's unclear when he'll return to Brazil. Bolsonaro faces a string of investigations from his time in office. Parts of Northern California are still under flood warnings tonight following extreme rain over New Year's weekend. Downpours in San Francisco filled roadways and stranded cars. Some people resorted to makeshift rafts to find their way around the city. Another strong storm is expected late Tuesday. In the Philippines, thousands of people remain in emergency shelters a week after devastating Christmas flooding. The death toll climbed again today to at least 51, most from drowning and landslides. More than 4,500 homes have been damaged, and some areas still have no power and water. And Australia and Canada are joining the U.S. and other countries imposing COVID testing rules for travelers from China. Starting January 5th, they have to show negative results from tests within 24 hours of departure. Infections have exploded across China as the government abruptly ended its strict policy of testing and quarantines. And still to come on the PBS NewsHour, Republicans wrangle over who should become Speaker as they take over the House. And the legacy of broadcast journalist icon Barbara Walters. Plus, celebrating Cuban-born composer and conductor Tania Leon's impact on music.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
Today, Moscow said a Ukrainian attack over the weekend in Russian-occupied Donetsk killed at least 60 soldiers, making it one of the deadliest incidents for Russia in 10 months of war. And in the early hours of this morning, Russia launched one of its largest barrages of drone strikes on Ukraine's capital of Kyiv. Ukraine says it shot down nearly all of them. But as Nick Schifrin reports, it's been a violent beginning to a new year of war in Ukraine.
In a nation at war, war does not take a holiday. And so over New Year's, Ukrainian rockets destroyed this building housing Russian troops. And for 3 days straight, Russia terrorized Kyiv from the sky. At least 60 drones targeted Ukraine's capital. Some eluded Ukrainian air defenses. The targets were yet again civilian, ripping open this hotel, damaging the apartments of some of Kyiv's most vulnerable, and destroying families in their homes. This used to be the Kaharilitsky's kitchen. A Russian missile landed a direct hit, killing 36-year-old Irina. 2 days later, Serhii looks for pieces of the weapon that killed her. He mourns his wife and embraces their son, who's lost his mother. His 73-year-old father, Anatoly, was injured in the same explosion.
You know, we were building this house for 5-6 years with our salary, with our money, and this happens. What can I say? They are beasts. They are not human.
And yet, amidst the torment, there is tenacity. Ukrainians in Kyiv managed to celebrate New Year's, hoping for the total victory that, despite all the fear of 10 months ago, President Volodymyr Zelensky vowed to achieve in his New Year's address.
It was dark. It was loud. It was hard for many and scary for some. 311 days have passed. It can still be dark, loud, and complicated for us. But we will definitely never be afraid again.
And yet he acknowledged the country's pain, written on the face of little girls who watched his address as their family marked a new year.
Kharkiv.
Mriya. But Zelensky claimed, as Abraham Lincoln did 160 years ago after Gettysburg, that war has created a new nation.
We woke up on February 24th into another life, being another people, another Ukrainians. On February 24th, millions of us made a choice, not a white flag, but a blue and yellow flag. Not escaping, but meeting the enemy.
Simultaneously on Russian TV, President Vladimir Putin delivered his own message and claimed historical truth is on Russia's side.
This has been a year of difficult, necessary decisions, of crucial steps towards Russia's full sovereignty and the powerful consolidation of our society.
He posed with troops and once again blamed the war on the West.
They cynically use Ukraine and its people to weaken and divide Russia. We have never allowed anyone to do that, and we will not allow anyone to do that.
And so the war goes on. The front line is 700 miles long, and there is endless destruction in a war without rest. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Nick Schifrin.
For more on the state of the war, we turn to Nicholas Vozdev. He's a professor of national security at the U.S. Naval War College and has written extensively about Russia, the Soviet Union, and Ukraine. Nicholas, welcome, and thanks for joining us. Let's start with that news, Russia acknowledging dozens of their soldiers killed in a Ukrainian strike. What does this tell us about Ukrainian forces' capabilities and their strategy right now?
First, it's showing that months, if not years, of Western training and equipping of Ukrainian forces is paying off. The Ukrainians are being able to connect real-time intelligence with their artillery to be able to deliver devastating strikes, in this particular case, against Russian forces. What it does, however, signal is that the Ukrainians are concerned about the shift in Russian strategy over the last several weeks. The Russians are digging in. The Russians do not want to lose more territory in Ukraine that they have already lost since the Ukrainian counteroffensives began in the fall. They're digging in. They want to prevent further Ukrainian moves. And so I would agree with my fellow analyst, Michael Kaufman, who argues that we're seeing the Ukrainians shifting towards targeting Russian positions, targeting Russian personnel, in order to weaken those Russian defensive capabilities, which the Ukrainians will have to do if they want to resume their ability to retake land later in the spring.
Nicholas, this was a building housing many Russian soldiers, storing a lot of their ammunition. How did the Russians not see this coming?
Well, this is a question that many on Russian social media are also asking. They're asking, after 11 months of this war, why have the Russian military not learned the lessons? Why have they continued to underestimate Ukrainian intelligence and reconnaissance capabilities, the ability of the Ukrainians to direct artillery and missile fire, and why no one seemed to be held accountable for Russian failures in the so-called special military operation? It should have been anticipated that a concentration of forces and next to an ammunition dump less than 15 kilometers away from an active front line might be a target. And it does, again, suggest that the Russians are not learning from some of their mistakes that they've been making throughout the course of the invasion.
You mentioned the Russians are digging in, but they're also continuing with this somewhat relentless campaign of drone strikes, right? There were a number of reports for a long time about Russian resources being depleted. These strikes seem to suggest that's not true.
That's correct. I think we need to be very careful about making assessments that Russia is running out of anything. The Russian military is the heir of the Soviet military. This was not a military force that believed in just-in-time supply chains. This was a military that believed in extensive stockpiling. There has been also the retention of speeding up capabilities, that is, to be able to convert industry back to military production. And finally, when we're reading reports about Russia obtaining supplies from North Korea, from Iran, from other sources, keep in mind that they are dealing with countries that have had extensive defense cooperation with first the Soviet Union and then with Russia. And so in a way, they're able to offshore some of their military production and then to bring that back into use in Ukraine. So we need to be careful about putting any definitive dates about when the Russians are likely to run out of missiles, artillery shells, or other types of ordnance.
Meanwhile, the longer this goes on and as the death toll mounts, do you see any loss of support for the war back in Ukraine? Any cracks or fissures in the Kremlin leadership?
That will depend on whether or not Russia needs to go through another round of military mobilization, that they need to really widen the draft and touch more ordinary families that so far have been somewhat insulated from the conflict. But we're also seeing criticism from Putin's right, so to speak, that he has not been decisive enough, that he is protecting those who have led the failures in Ukraine over the last number of months. And Defense Minister Shoigu has been a particular target of criticism. There's also been criticism that Putin has not done enough to crack down on the corruption in the Russian military-industrial complex. And this is also contributing to Russian failures. This could lead to problems on his end. And then finally, the wild card question of if and when economic sanctions against Russia really begin to cut into the Russian economy in such a way and to bring such a level of pain to the average Russian household and also to the Russian elites that they might be inclined to pressure the Kremlin to change course.
And that war in Ukraine, of course, now more than 10 months on. That is Nicholas Vozdev, professor of national security at the U.S. Naval War College, joining us tonight. Thank you.
Thank you.
Tomorrow marks the start of a new Congress, but the story at the Capitol is a familiar one, chaos, this time inside the incoming Republican House majority, as leader Kevin McCarthy vies to become Speaker of the House. Following it all is our Capitol Hill correspondent, Lisa Desjardins, and White House correspondent, Laura Barrón-López.
So let's jump right in, Lisa, because the start of the new Congress is less than 24 hours away. Kevin McCarthy, the House Republican leader, doesn't have the votes to become House Speaker. Why not? Who's standing in his way?
Let's start with some simple math here. It's not good math for Kevin McCarthy. First of all, House Republicans come into this session of Congress with 222 members. But to absolutely clinch the speakership, you need a majority of the House. That's 218. That's easy math. So Kevin McCarthy can spare all of his Republicans except for four. Here's the problem. Not yet on board with Mr. McCarthy, 14 or more members of his own party say that they're not there yet. Now, some of these groups say they are a hard no. There's others who came out with a letter yesterday after Mr. McCarthy proposed a sweeping amount of changes that they said they wanted. They said they're still not there yet. Here's an excerpt from that letter of this group that I call Not Yet, Kevin. They say there continue to be missing specific commitments with respect to virtually every component of our entreaties. What does that mean? They don't trust him. They don't believe he's made firm enough commitments. Talking with some of these members today, talking with those around them, the mood from those folks are, let's just go ahead and do it. In fact, one of them said, why not open this Pandora's box? This is legislating. It's okay if there's a little chaos. The rest of the Republican Party may not agree with that.
Well, let's talk more about that dynamic, because as you point out, Leader McCarthy has given his skeptics nearly everything they want, and yet that doesn't appear to be enough to get them to yes.
That's correct. One of the problems here is that while there are not right now the votes for Kevin McCarthy, there also are not necessarily the votes for anyone else, because some of Mr. McCarthy's allies have said, we aren't going to support anyone else. Here's a letter from some of his allies, people that call themselves only Kevin. What they wrote is, we are not only supporting Kevin McCarthy for speaker, but we are not open to any so-called shadow consensus candidate. In addition, those members, some of them say they don't like the rules changes that those other conservatives want, which would mean individuals have more power to affect but also disrupt the Republican agenda. So there's a real difficulty here on both sides.
Is there a viable alternative to Kevin McCarthy if this vote goes to multiple ballots, the first time in some 100 years that that would happen? Is there someone waiting in the wings, a Republican who could emerge as House Speaker?
Currently, no one announced, but we're watching some people, Steve Scalise, the number two Republican in the House. There is, of course, sort of an Aaron Sorkin type of dream of some moderates, of Fred Upton, a retired now member of the House. You don't have to be a member to be Speaker. However, I really think that that is just a fantasy. I don't see him being able to get those votes. In fact, some of the members who said they were never Kevin today have been speaking out. Here's Bob Good from Virginia. They say they have some kind of candidate ready to go.
I think you'll see on the second ballot an increasing number of members vote for a true candidate who can represent the conservative center of the conference, can motivate the base, inspire Republicans across the country, get to 218 votes.
Who's this candidate? I don't know. The honest truth is the line between political reality and fantasy right now is very murky, and we just don't know. We know tomorrow will be a long day.
Laura, what's the White House view of things? I spoke with a senior administration official who said that the president will use this moment to draw a contrast. He's going to go across the country, tout investments in infrastructure, while the Republicans are back here in Washington trying to sort all of this out.
Well, he's starting those tours this week. President Biden is going to go to Covington, Kentucky, and he's going to appear alongside Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, which is a pretty big deal. Biden is already striking that contrast with McConnell to show that, one, the White House tells me the main messages are, one, that he cares about bipartisanship and that he's going to continue to care about that and demonstrating his track record of that for the foreseeable future, for the second half of his term. The second message that they're trying to send with that is that this year is going to be heavily focused on implementation, on the implementation of that infrastructure, bipartisan infrastructure bill, of the Inflation Reduction Act, and also of the semiconductors bill that they saw passed. So all of that, he's joined on the road this week as well with Vice President Kamala Harris, as well as Leader McConnell, right? But they're spreading out across the country. So as well as Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg, they're going to other parts of the country. I think it's also important to say that McConnell is clearly striking a contrast himself here. Yeah. He doesn't do anything unintentionally, and he has made very clear that he does not like the chaos that Republicans have been involved in, and that is potentially happening on the House GOP side.
Is a divided Republican Party in the House, how useful is that to the White House, especially as we head into an election year next year? I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves, but in 2024.
The White House is looking forward to, all the sources that I talk to inside the White House officials I talk to, is looking forward to the ability to, as you say, Jeff, strike that contrast, to show that now Republicans are in charge of one of the chambers in Congress, and are they going to actually work with the president and the Senate to accomplish anything? One thing that they keep bringing up is that this statistic, that the past two Democratic presidents that won re-election had a House GOP to contend with in their first term, whereas the president that didn't, Jimmy Carter, lost re-election. So they're looking forward to being more aggressive with this House GOP at every turn. We've already seen some of that since the midterms, as they've tried to push back on Trump's comments about the insurrection, as well as a number of House GOPers' comments about the insurrection.
In the 30 seconds we have left, what are you going to be watching for tomorrow?
Oh, gosh, I will be watching for the people standing up and announcing their votes, and I will be keeping tally on pen and paper. So
I'm sure you will. Lisa Desjardins, Laura Verón-Lopez, thank you both.
Months after Pakistan's historic flooding that killed more than 1,700 people, the South Asian nation is still struggling to recover. And the United Nations is warning it might soon have to suspend its food support program for flood victims because it's running out of money. Fred DeSam-Lazaro has the latest from one of the hardest hit provinces of Sindh. This story is produced in partnership with the Pulitzer Center and part of Fred's series, Agents for Change.
Pakistan is no stranger to flooding, but this time the water never left. Huge swaths of land, farms, and towns remain underwater.
4 months after the flood, this school in the Dadu district, like so many others, remains inaccessible to students. Its first floor still completely inundated. The building used to be surrounded by rice fields. It's now surrounded by a lake.
The school community is now scattered among some of the 5 million people still living in flimsy shelters like these.
Our house is broken, our animal livestock has been lost, our homes collapsed, my son died. We have nothing. We are just sitting here helpless.
Our house fell down. My brother died in the flood. He fell in the river and died.
Scientists blame a cataclysmic combination of glacier melts and monsoon rains, both intensified by climate change. It poured without interruption for days in a row, overwhelming a country that was ill-prepared and under-resourced.
When we have these climate calamities, everyone's affected, but women and children are affected in particular.
Simi Kamal heads a Karachi-based foundation focused on development issues.
In a society where social services are almost completely absent, and a lot of people survive on philanthropy and charity,
the school in Dadu is one example, one of 1,800 run by a private charity called the Citizens Foundation. Before the flood, some 700 children attended the school. Now, only about half the students have returned to a makeshift, mostly outdoor facility in a community center.
The children are in extreme trauma. They're suffering from lots of difficulties. They don't have proper homes or food to achieve their goals.
Principals Shabroz Mirani and Umbreen Babar no longer have access to the library, school records, or electricity, but they persist, trying to bring some stability to the children's lives.
How many children in this school today have eaten lunch?
So we have lots of students that don't eat anything.
Malnutrition is made that much worse by living conditions. Standing water has drowned crops and spawned pathogens. Malaria, dengue, skin and diarrheal diseases have all soared.
About 500 children are brought into the pediatric emergency room at this hospital every single day. That's more than double the number prior to the flood. And they are coming in far sicker.
This ER in the town of Larkana is run by the Child Life Foundation, a separate charity that partners with struggling public hospitals to modernize pediatric emergency care across the country.
During flood, we have seen gastroenteritis, pneumonia, and malaria. That was common.
Dr. Sohail Akbar works in the labor and delivery and neonatal units.
But now, malaria number is increased, and now also have malnutrition, and also the preterm babies.
Preterm babies.
Because a mother, pregnant female, she is not having enough nutrition.
On this day, Dr. Akbar was discharging four-month-old baby Muhammad Bilal, who was rushed here by his parents in severe breathing distress. A day later, with antibiotics and oxygen therapy, he was stabilized, able to breastfeed and breathe on his own. The care package of nutrition supplements will help a bit, but young Bilal, seriously underweight at just 4.5 pounds, was hardly in good health as his family brought him home from the hospital to a tent that sits amid the rubble of the home they lost. It collapsed on the second day of the rains. Already deep in debt for a motorcycle taxi business, Bilal's father, Ijar ul Haq, has no idea how they'll rebuild.
The doctor has said that we have to be very careful of cleanliness. We have to keep the child warm. We have to ensure the child has medication.
Doctor's instructions they're not sure they can afford. 2-year-old daughter Tanzila has also had health problems, including malaria, says grandmother Nusrat Khatun, who lives with the young family.
It's been a very tough time. I'm a mother. My prayers are that my daughter has a good life, but she does not. We now will pray that our grandchildren will have better lives than their mother does.
Whether that generational cycle of hope and despair for millions of families will be broken this time is an open question. Simi Kamal is skeptical.
We had horrible floods 10 years ago. We never learned anything from it. No, we don't have the political will to actually build the kind of local government we need, and government at every tier to be able to tackle these problems. And they're going to keep happening. But that doesn't mean we don't take action. So each one of us has to take action by speaking up, by writing, by supporting or lobbying for change.
Officials say it may take until the early weeks of this year for the remaining water to disappear, for farmland to be farmed again. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Fred DeSamlazaro in Sindh Province, Pakistan.
Tomorrow, Fred's next report will explore some of the reasons why the flooding has been so bad and what could have been done to prevent another disaster. And a reminder, Fred's reporting is a partnership with the Undertold Stories Project at the University of St. Thomas in Minnesota.
The start of this new year is bringing with it some new state laws. Thousands of bills were passed in state legislatures last year, but there are a few issues in particular that stand out, for which a number of states have decided to take action. Stephanie Tsai has a look at some of the changes on the way.
In the wake of the Supreme Court's decision overturning Roe v. Wade, some states have new laws taking effect to protect abortion services.
The number one issue for me is women's rights. And all of our rights that are being slowly taken away from us.
That includes California and New York, which would expand abortion care. But in Tennessee, a new restriction on abortion went into effect that requires a licensed physician to prescribe abortion pills. Tennessee already has a near total ban on abortion, alongside 12 other so-called red states. There's much less polarization around legalizing weed. Last week, celebration erupted at the historic opening sale of New York's first marijuana dispensary. The state, which legalized cannabis last year, will now sell it to anyone over 21. Recreational use of marijuana was also legalized in Missouri and Maryland. Workers in at least 23 states will get higher paychecks this year as new minimum wage increases kick in. But the size of that increase varies. In Nebraska, it's gone from $9 to $10.50 an hour. And in Washington, D.C., it will hike up to $17 an hour in July. To alleviate the pain of inflation, Kansas and Virginia are lowering their sales taxes on groceries. And about two-thirds of states also approved income tax cuts or rebates last year, with many taking effect this month.
2023 is expected to be yet another busy year on the state level, especially with divided federal government. Reed Wilson tracks this all closely as the founder and editor of the state news website, Pluribus News, and he joins me now. Reed, Happy New Year, and thank you so much for joining the NewsHour. I want to launch right into this. So several state legislators addressed the abortion issue last year. How high does that remain on state legislatures' priority lists in this new year?
I think it's going to be tremendously high. We're going to see divergent states here, really the red states and blue states of America. Red states are going to try to continue restricting abortion, and that's actually bringing up an interesting conflict within the Republican Party. How far do you go? Do you ban abortions beginning at 15 weeks, at 6 weeks, or altogether? And if altogether, should there be exceptions in cases of rape or incest or even the life of the mother? On the other hand, blue states are moving fast to codify abortion and reproductive rights in their state constitutions. And a number of blue states are also working on data privacy laws that would specifically shield people who come to those states from red states seeking reproductive health care and shield their data from red states that might try to prosecute them.
Reed, we just heard what some states are doing to try and alleviate inflation, but what else are you seeing state legislatures do in terms of trying to compete economically with other states?
You know, a decade ago when I started reporting on state politics, the story was really about states competing for businesses, trying to land businesses in their states. Now states are competing for workers, and that's a sea change that it's hard to describe sort of the magnitude of. And the fact is, in areas across the economy, there are massive worker shortages, thousands of teacher shortages, thousands of manufacturing worker shortages, thousands of correction worker shortages. As the baby boom generation begins retiring, or continues to retire, we're going to see those workforce shortages exacerbated. So states right now are doing as much as they can to attract people to their borders and to train up the next generation of workers, whether that's in community colleges or technical education, even reducing licensure requirements. States realize, I think, that a state without a workforce is a state that doesn't have much of an economic future.
I want to turn to some other major issues that you mentioned in a post today on Pluribus. You're seeing states tackle the issue of mental health. What kinds of laws are you seeing considered around that issue, which, of course, we really saw come to the forefront during the pandemic?
Yeah, and it's only gotten worse during the pandemic. The drug overdose crisis, the loneliness crisis in America, and more legislators are trying to figure out how to tackle what is the mammoth challenge of the next decade, how to build more facilities, how to get more people spotting those who might have mental health problems, whether it's at school in terms of teachers and counselors or in the workplace and beyond. One of the big crises, though, that the mental health field is facing is a workforce challenge. There simply aren't enough doctors, nurses, providers who can staff the beds needed in a lot of these hospitals. I've been talking to legislators who are 200 and 300 doctors short, in their own little legislative district.
You also mentioned in your blog election reform. This was a midterm election issue where you saw some Republican candidates talk about, for example, the need for stricter voting ID laws. It appears you think that will be a theme again for legislatures in 2023.
So I see this as another issue where red America and blue America are diverging significantly. We're going to see a lot of red states tackling those, what they would call election integrity issues over and over again, voter ID, limiting the number of early voting days, cracking down on absentee ballots and the requirements for signatures and dates and things like that. In blue states, you're going to see a lot of expanding the franchise, trying to add early voting days, trying to get more people to show up to vote. Democrats think that this midterm election gave them a mandate to fix voting laws in America, and we're going to see a lot of blue states trying to pursue that. Now, there is a middle course here, and that middle course is something that would speed up the actual counting of elections. I think you're going to see both Democrats and Republicans spending money on election administration, which is, you know, a core part of our democracy, but which isn't always funded as well as it needs to be. If those funds come through, hopefully we'll see ballots counted a lot faster in the future.
Well, it should be an interesting year. Reed Wilson, the editor and founder of Pluribus News. Thanks so much for joining the NewsHour.
Thanks for having me.
Three years into the pandemic, and yet another new subvariant of the coronavirus has emerged. As William Brangham explains, it's spreading rapidly, and it's driving an uptick in new infections.
This new Omicron subvariant, known as XBB.1.5, now accounts for more than 40% of new COVID infections here in the U.S. and around 75% of cases in the Northeast. This new variant emerges while just over a third of Americans, 65 and older, those at most risk for severe outcomes, have gotten the updated booster shot. As China deals with a massive surge in cases, this week the U.S. will require a negative COVID test from passengers flying from China to the United States. Dr. Jay Varma is a physician and epidemiologist. He's also a professor and director of the Cornell Center for Pandemic Prevention and Response. Dr. Varma, great to have you back on the NewsHour. So there are these various COVID alarm bells that are ringing. Cases are rising. Some localities are asking for masks to be put back on with some mandates. And now this new variant has emerged, XBB. How worried should we be about this variant?
I think it's important for all Americans to understand that, you know, this is a very precarious time for a healthcare system. So we're dealing with new COVID variants. We're dealing with, you know, potential surge in infections that might arise from infections around the world. And we still have influenza and RSV to deal with. So I don't think Americans should be unduly alarmed. You know, this variant is going to be causing some of the similar ups and downs as we saw earlier this year. But at the same time, it's just yet another reminder about the importance of vaccines and high quality masks.
So the initial reports that had come out that XBB.1.5 might be more able to evade our immunity, either from vaccines or prior infection, those aren't as alarming to you?
So what's concerning is that, similar to these other Omicron variants, it's going to make people more likely to catch COVID. You know, similar to other variants, however, it doesn't appear that it's going to increase the risk of hospitalization and death beyond what has already happened in the past before. So again, more likely to get infected, but if you have vaccines and you have prior infections, you have similar level of protection. I think the other thing that is worrisome is, however, you know, one part of our treatment arsenal, what was known as monoclonal antibodies, is no longer effective anymore. So it really leaves us only with Paxlovid, the one drug that's widely available, as our effective treatment option.
I mentioned the low booster rate for Americans. Beyond that, some places are starting to require masks, but as I've traveled around the country, and I'm sure you know this as well, most Americans are just not wearing masks and seem to have no interest in them again. I did see the mayor of your city, Eric Adams, was wearing a mask in a public space, an indoor space. I'm just curious what you think the government's position ought to be now with regards to masking.
Yeah, you know, every time we think about public health, we think about, you know, what works scientifically, but also what's acceptable and what's likely that people are going to do. And masks are the perfect example. We know that a high quality mask will protect you as an individual. And we know if lots of people do them, it can reduce the stress on our healthcare system. But we also know that a lot of Americans are tired of wearing them. So I like what's happening in New York, where elected officials are modeling good behavior, because we know that social norms are important, even if you don't have a mandate. The other thing I wish governments were doing is making high quality masks widely available, just like we have toilet paper in every bathroom. Doesn't mean you have to use it, but it's just yet another reminder, and reducing that friction so that people who do feel like they might want to wear one have one always available.
So separately, I mentioned, we know cases are surging in China, seemingly as they have somewhat done an about face on their zero COVID policy. And in response, the Biden administration says later this week, you need a negative test to get into the country from China. Administration officials say that this is a prudent and smart thing to do. One global health expert I talked to said today he didn't think it was going to have any real impact. What is your take on this?
Yeah, I'm pretty skeptical that it'll have any public health impact. There is so much COVID transmission occurring, not just here in the United States, but all over the world. You know, most countries around the world have removed almost all of their COVID mitigation strategies. So even though, you know, China has an enormous population that's at risk of getting infected over the next few months, I'm not convinced that that's likely to, you know, change the burden of disease here in the United States.
As you well know, so much of the country seemingly has just moved on from talk of COVID or action against COVID. What should the government's response be in that case?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very natural human phenomenon. You know, trying to to wear masks, get vaccinated, be cautious, takes work, and work is exhausting. So I do feel that government has a responsibility to continue to remind Americans about how many people are dying every day, because it's important to stay up to date in your vaccines and to have masks and tests available when you need them. I mean, just in my own personal life, I had dinner with my wife and a few friends at our home the other night, and they were not aware that 15 to 20 New Yorkers are literally dying every day for the past several weeks from COVID. So, you know, I do think it's important for government to remind people, and as I mentioned before, to make tools such as tests, masks, and drugs frictionless so that everybody has access to them.
All right, Dr. Jay Varma of Weill Cornell Medicine, always good to see you. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, William, for having me.
Much is known about the storied career of the legendary journalist Barbara Walters, who died over the weekend at the age of 93. But less is known about who she was as a person and the high cost her professional success took on her personal life. For a fuller picture of the iconic broadcaster's life on camera and off, we're joined by Susan Page, the author of an upcoming biography of Walters. Susan, welcome back. Good to see you.
It's great to be with you.
You have been interviewing a number of people sharing accounts about Barbara Walters and her life. You've been reporting on this for almost 2 years. Talk to me about the earliest days of her career. There weren't a lot of women in the business when she broke in. How did she do it?
She did it by just being the hardest working, most persistent person you can imagine. She overcame impossible obstacles, including the fact that she didn't really speak very well. She had this sort of odd speaking pattern, and yet she managed to succeed in this business against all odds.
Her big break came when she was named co-host of NBC's Today Show. How did she land that job?
Oh, so there's a great story. So she's working on the Today Show with Frank McGee, the host, who didn't like her at all, didn't think of her as a real journalist. And he went to the head of the network and got a rule set that when they were doing an interview, he would ask the first three questions, and only then was she allowed to speak. And she lived by that. She then started doing interviews outside the studio in an effort to be able to ask the first question and the second one. But then Frank McGee unexpectedly died in 1974 of cancer. He was in his 50s. No one knew that he was so ill. And NBC announced that they were going to be looking for a new host for the Today Show. And Barbara Walters' agent, Lee Stevens, called the executives and said, "You mean co-host?" Because as it turned out, they had put in her last contract a provision that said if Frank McGee leaves for any reason, mm-hmm. Barbara Walters will become co-host, something that the NBC executives hadn't even paid much attention to. That is how she broke that first barrier, the first woman to be a co-host at a morning show. And of course, today you can't imagine a morning show that wouldn't have a woman on the air.
What about how she worked? Was she competitive?
She was fiercely competitive. And of course, she had to be. Men and women in that job would have to be. She had to be especially so. She was constantly working to get the big interviews, the big gets, which was one of the things she made into an art. When she was trying to interview Mark David Chapman, the man who murdered John Lennon, she wrote to him in prison for 12 years before he agreed to give his first TV interview to her.
She was known for her relentless work ethic, too. That had to take a toll on her relationships. How did that impact both her professional relationships and also her personal ones?
You know, we think now of all the accolades she's getting as this wonderful groundbreaker, cut a path for so many women who followed, and all that's true, but it was not free. Three marriages, three divorces. She was long estranged from her only daughter, although they eventually reconciled. Her work always came first, and everyone around her, family and friends, understood that.
Did she ever express any regret about that or articulate a wish that she might have done things differently?
You know, she would sometimes talk about, did I make a mistake? But then she would say, but if I hadn't done this, I wouldn't have gotten where I am. So I think she was not a woman who was given to many regrets.
You have spoken to how many people so far?
More than 100.
This upcoming book, more than 100. Did anything you've heard surprise you so far?
A lot of it has surprised me. One is how hard she worked. Another is what a good friend she was to some other women. She was very competitive with women like Diane Sawyer, with whom she felt a special rivalry. But to women like Connie Chung and Katie Couric and Lynn Shear, they have all told me stories about how helpful she was to them in their careers.
Over the course of that career, almost 50 years, right, working in this industry, she moved across news and entertainment seamlessly. She innovated a lot as well. When you look at the industry, where is her mark today? And tell me about what happened to her life after she left working in television.
Of course, she spans the whole story of the rise and then the challenges that network television has faced. And think about what she innovated. She innovated kind of the blending of news and entertainment. Not everybody thought that was a good idea, but it's undeniable that that has happened. She defined the big interview get, including Monica Lewinsky, an interview that got nearly 50 million people to watch her. And she was 67 years old at a time almost everybody would be retiring. She created The View, a whole new form of TV talk show, one that 25 years later is still going strong.
Was she okay being out of the spotlight?
I think it was hard for her to retire. I think it was hard for her to step away. She was in her 80s by the time she retired. And then she had a long period where her health failed, where she was increasingly isolated. And I'm sure it was very hard for her to not be on TV.
We've lost one of the greats. We can't wait to read many of those stories in your upcoming biography of her, Barbara Walters. Susan Page, thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
A major American composer with her own deeply American story to tell is receiving recognition for a lifetime of work. Jeffrey Brown talks to newly minted Kennedy Center honoree Tanya Leon for our arts and culture series, Canvas.
A work titled Stride. Based on the struggles of women for equal rights, it's a celebration of achievement. Composed by Tanya Leon, it was commissioned by the New York Philharmonic and won the Pulitzer Prize for Music in 2021. There was Leon at the Kennedy Center Honors in December, receiving more recognition for a lifetime as a pathbreaking composer. Known for mixing traditional orchestral sounds and Latin rhythms. And as a conductor and advocate for contemporary music in all its diversity. As she put it recently at her home in Nyack, New York, she has always lived in a state of wonder.
I keep talking about the fact that, yes, my spirit resides here, but I mean, through my eyes is little Tanya looking out.
Little Tanya?
Yes. It's like, oh my God, look at this, look at that.
And now you're looking at older Tanya getting all kinds of honors.
It's unimaginable.
Now 79, she's been performing and having her work performed for many decades. But she easily recalls the working class Havana neighborhood where she grew up. Her grandmother and mother had worked as maids as children. But when Leon showed an early love of music, her family made sure she would have opportunities, including music lessons in a conservatory beginning at age 4.
I call it the Tanya Project.
The Tanya Project?
Yes.
What does that mean?
The Tanya Family Project.
Yeah.
Yes.
You were the project?
Exactly right.
The original goal, to be a concert pianist. She got an accounting degree as well, just in case. But in 1967, at age 24, she left Castro's Cuba alone, a refugee on what were known as freedom flights, and essentially started over in New York. A chance meeting with famed dancer and choreographer Arthur Mitchell, founder of the Dance Theater of Harlem, changed everything. When he invited her not only to play piano, but to compose the music for a ballet.
I saw the entire thing on stage. And the recording, which I was a pianist in the recording, and the lights and the audience and the whole thing, and I said, oh my God.
You were hooked?
Yes.
She's gone on to compose some 40 chamber works, 10 orchestral pieces, one opera, and numerous solo piano works. But early on, a comment from her father also helped change her sound.
My father, the last time that I saw him, he said that my music was very interesting, but where are you in your music?
Where are you in your music?
Exactly, yeah, ah. Yeah. He perceived that something was missing of the Tanya that he knew. It was my intuition, in a way, to realize that there were a lot of things that I knew about rhythm, about syntax, about traces of influences of the Cuban music, mm-hmm. that I could use in my music if I wanted to.
So you've circled something.
Yes, because I definitely like this combination.
Leon sketches out short sequences and passages in a notebook she always carries, and then tries them out at the piano. Eventually, some will make it into her scores.
When I get an idea, I write it somewhere.
The ideas can and do come anytime and anywhere, including while shopping for groceries.
You mean between the oranges and the bananas, you hear a passage of
yes,
music?
Yes, maybe. I am actually dealing with the oranges and the bananas, but my mind or my subconscious is working on something.
Yeah.
And then I hear it. And when I hear it that clear,
yeah.
And I said, wait a minute, I have to write this down. If somebody see me writing music in the middle of the grocery, they probably think, is she nuts?
A strong sense of humor, a strong sense of purpose and determination. As a woman of color in the classical music culture that hasn't traditionally been open to either, she's needed both and pushed for more opportunities for herself and others at the podium and as composers.
There have been all kind of instances, you know, of people saying things.
What were you being told? You mean that,
well,
that
I mean,
as a woman,
you know, a woman of color, I mean, conducting an orchestra.
She developed close relations with mentors, including Leonard Bernstein, and founded an organization called Composers Now to foster more diversity in new music and serve as a mentor in her own right.
I'm not the kind of person that gets impressed when somebody is predicting my future. I just smile and say, well, it's like, who are you to tell me what is going to happen with me, you know, that kind of thing. And I think that that comes from the encouragement that I got from my family. You know, I mean, for them, I could do anything. And that was very, very inspiring, because now that they are not around, I still hear them telling me, you can do it. I'm just me, you know, and this is the way I look like. And I have no problem as far as the way I look like.
You mean you refuse to be put into a
I don't like categories. No. I mean, I think that labels is the worst thing that you can do for a human being.
But people do want to label you.
Oh, I have been labeled. I mean, even I am a rare bird. Even that one.
Not until 2010, 43 years after she left, was Leon's music played in Cuba. And in 2016, she returned as composer and conductor, leading the National Symphony Orchestra of Cuba. And today, she continues to receive commissions at home and abroad.
How important has it been to you to kind of expand the audience for classical music?
Because of accessibility, people didn't realize that there are composers that look like me, you see? And that there is an opportunity to understand why I do what I do, what I write, what I write. And the minute that they get this close to me as a human being, all of a sudden they start listening to the music, first as a curiosity, and then because they know me.
Tanya Leon is currently working on an orchestral piece and another set to a text by former poet laureate Rita Dove. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jeffrey Brown in Nyack, New York.
It's really great to see her get this well-deserved and long-overdue recognition.
It is. Long overdue. She's getting it. Now, I love the advice from her dad, by the way. Put yourself into the music. Dads know best, right?
That's true. There is a lot more online at pbs.org/newshour, including a story about an effort to make popular tabletop games like Dungeons & Dragons more inclusive.
And join us again here tomorrow night for the latest on Capitol Hill as Republicans take control of the U.S. House and vote on the next House Speaker. That is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Amna Nawaz.
And I'm Jeff Bennett. Thanks for spending part of your evening with us.